You've tuned into KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for joining us. For the past few weeks, we've been following the path of gentrification from the Central District into South Seattle. As land values go up, people start to feel the pressure to leave. That is starting to happen in Rainier Beach. KUOW's growth and development reporter Joshua McNichols says Rainier Beach is home to a big minority population and what is arguably Seattle's last big family farm.
There are horses on Henderson Street. They're headed from their farm, right by the Rainier Beach Light Rail Station, down to the shore of Lake Washington. They're passing through one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the city, and they really stick out.
Look at that! Magnificent animals! Oh my gosh! Look at that! You see how, look at that!
The horses splash into Lake Washington and go for a swim.
It's a beautiful thing right here. You get in the water like that? Gallop in the water?
Everywhere, people stop and stare. It's a reminder of how much the neighborhood has changed. This area used to be all farms.
We have never lost faith in this area, and we've thought it's been wonderful through all the transitions that it's been through.
That's Lisa Safera, who owns the farm now. Seated beside her is her mother, Gloria Safera, who owned it before her. During the Great Depression, this farm got the family through.
My own father had a milk route, and he had a Red Flyer wagon, and he used to walk around and sell like pints of milk to the neighbors.
The freeway, Boeing Field, and the development of Rainier Beach, they all came later. The farm became an anachronism. One time their steer escaped and ran down Interstate 5 towards Seattle. The traffic backed up for miles.
Because he would dart back and forth. You couldn't get past him. You didn't know what lane to take because he was running sideways and doing all kinds of stuff.
14-year-old Lisa and her sister found the steer by following the news helicopters overhead. They coaxed him into a trailer and took him home.
He had been galloping a long way, and he was really fat, and he wasn't in shape. And when he came home, he laid down immediately in the barn.
In the decades since the steer got out, Rainier Beach kept changing. African Americans moved here from the Central District. Refugees moved here from around the world. Millionaires snapped up the waterfront property. With all that demand, land prices rose, and the farm started getting offers from developers.
And one letter said, "Why don't you sell your property because obviously you're not using it?"
But the farm faced a bigger threat when it passed from Gloria Safera's generation to the next. Gloria divided the farm up between her two daughters. Lisa wanted to keep the farm, but her sister was thinking of selling.
Those were really trying times for me.
They went through mediation to come up with a fair price. Lisa bought her sister out, and the farm was saved, at least for this generation. But other residents in Rainier Beach may not be able to stick it out. Light rail has increased the accessibility of this neighborhood, and rents are rising here once again. Rainier Beach's Sharon Stewart Silvano recently got a letter from her landlord.
And the letter basically said, you know, thank you for being good renters. The house is going to get remodeled and then it's going to be sold.
Stewart Silvano and her family will have to move. Over 5 years, she says she's paid $75,000 in rent. And now she feels like she has nothing to show for that.
We have a stake in, you know, Rainier Beach, and my kid has been in that neighborhood and has grown to be a young man. And we could still be where we were if we owned it, but we don't.
One day, Stewart Silvano saw the Safera family horses walking through Rainier Beach. She had never seen them before, so she assumed they were part of the gentrification that's been pushing her out.
These white women walk by on horses through a black place, and so at that time, it was like, is this a new discovery?
That's when I told her. That family and their farm have been in Rainier Beach for almost 100 years.
That's awesome. That 100 years, they stayed, that family stayed. They preserved their land, and they did not sell out. Wow.
Now she wants to show those horses to her own kids, because she thinks it's cool that this family survived. But the Saferas know they have to keep working to fit in here. New people are moving in. People online have been complaining about horse poop on the streets. The family knows they need to take these horses out to be seen and to talk to people. So at the end of the trail ride, they do something a little unusual.
Hi, can we have 5 soft serve ice cream cones?
They stop for ice cream at the McDonald's drive-thru. On horseback, of course.
Now we're serving with horses?
The McDonald's employees are good sports.
But it's okay. We solved it. We got it done.
Then the Safaris lead the horses back home to the barn for a well-deserved rest.
Where are you guys coming from? We're coming from the barn right up the hill.
In Rainier Beach, I'm Joshua McNichols for KUOW News.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. In the news today, Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. says it will give preference in admissions to the descendants of slaves owned by the Maryland Jesuits. In 1838, two priests who served as Georgetown presidents orchestrated the sale of 272 people to pay off debts at the school. The slaves were sent from Maryland to plantations in Louisiana. The school's president says Georgetown will identify and reach out to descendants of slaves and recruit them to the university. A university committee also recommends Georgetown offer a formal apology for its participation in the slave trade. Those are the basics. We're going to get more into the details of this story and how this came about coming up this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. And later this hour, we're going to look at a local organization working on racial justice. That's coming up later this hour in about a half hour, so stay with us.
I'm Joshua McNichols. This year, we've been reporting on our area's rapid growth in a series called Region of Boom. It asks, how can we create a community where we can all thrive? On September 15th, we're bringing Region of Boom to Town Hall. 13 local luminaries will present their take on the future of our changing region. For tickets and more information, go to kuow.org/events.
Back to school time means shiny new school supplies. Kids are heading off with their backpacks, their sharpened number 2 pencils, and so much more. Here to tell us about so much more is our education reporter, Ann Dornfeld, who's carrying a whole bunch of stuff. Hello, Ann.
Hey, Bill.
What do you have here?
I filled this backpack with a list of the required school supplies for first graders at my neighborhood elementary.
That's a large backpack.
Yeah, but hold on.
And now you've got a big plastic bin full of stuff.
There's a little bit more.
Oh, and
this one's kind of heavy.
Ann, are you okay?
Yeah, I think I got it.
This is not just number 2 pencils, and this is modern school supplies in Seattle?
Yeah, let's look at what we have here. We have, you know, you had a notebook when you were growing up.
Sure.
A three-ring notebook. Well,
three-ring binder.
3 of them required here. You probably needed some pencils, and we have
wire, spiral notebook.
Spiral notebook. Mm-hmm. And then some crayons.
24-pack.
Markers.
Yeah.
I couldn't find the washable kind, which are required. And then some things that you might not have brought to school when you were a kid, like 3 different sizes of Ziploc bags. A jumbo bag of napkins.
That's a huge Costco-looking package of napkins.
And 2 packages of hand sanitizer. And snack time rolls around. You need
Goldfish.
Goldfish. About, you're supposed to bring 2 bags. So the second bag. They're whole grain these days.
Of course.
Blue masking tape. And here's my favorite.
That's computer paper, copy paper.
Yeah, copy paper, 2 reams.
We know how heavy those are.
These are not light.
Is all this for one first grader?
This is all for one first grader at my neighborhood school.
I want to make sure I have this clear. You're saying each individual first grader is responsible for bringing or somehow getting to school this much supplies?
This is on their required list.
How is this possible that a first grader is expected to carry this much stuff and deliver and buy this much stuff?
Hopefully their parents helped out on both of those. But this costs about $120 to put together if you bought it online with mostly free shipping. But a lot of families don't shop online. And so this would probably be multiple trips to different stores because schools are really specific about the brands and the colors of all these things. And you also have to think about the time that it takes families, especially families who have multiple kids and different lists for each kid and who might not have that much time on the weekends, especially families working multiple jobs.
I know some parents are frustrated about this. What are they saying?
Well, some parents don't have the money for this, especially for multiple kids, or they know that other parents don't, and they're frustrated on those parents' behalf. And even if you have the money for it, you know that the economies of scale that a school would benefit from getting things like copy paper by the case instead of individual ream are pretty huge. So you're paying $8 a ream if you buy it individually. If you buy it by the case, you know, we're talking pennies on the dollar.
Why would the Seattle School District be doing it this way?
Well, it's not just Seattle. It's districts all over the state, and it's individual schools make their own decisions about how to handle supplies. But, you know, it started out with when you and I were in school, coming to school with some crayons and some notebook paper and a notebook and some pencils.
Elmer's glue.
Right. And it's kind of added on from there to the point where you have classroom supplies like Ziplocs and napkins. And then when you have front office supplies now, including copy paper.
Is anyone proposing a bigger solution to this school by school weighed down expensive situation?
Yeah, there are some schools that, for instance, have gotten donations from places like office supply stores, or they're asking parents to donate a certain amount of money on behalf of other families who can't afford it, and they're buying in bulk. But still, the typical school has every family, one by one, buying supplies for their own student, for other students in the classroom, for the teacher, and for the school. And that's not even talking about the amount of supplies that teachers are paying for out of pocket, hundreds or even thousands of dollars in many cases.
We are electing a new superintendent for public instruction this fall. Have either of those candidates proposed any solutions to this problem?
Well, you know, the overall solution that I think any SPI candidate would propose is that McCleary gets fully funded and that materials and supplies for classrooms are much more affordable for schools because they're getting a lot more money for those products and able to buy in bulk.
KUOW's education reporter Ann Dornfeld bearing the burden of covering the news for you. Ann, good luck getting out of here with this stuff.
Thanks. I got to go catch my school bus.
By the way, that was just a sampling of the stuff in Ann's two backpacks and a bin. We don't have enough time in this hour to list everything. You can see the list and some photos later today on KUOW.org. It'll take us a little time. We have to physically walk those photos all the way over to the website in a bulging backpack. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now, all of those school children are also arriving in the classrooms with their germs and maybe with their vaccines, maybe not. Vaccination rates are on the decline nationwide. A new University of Washington study finds nearly 90% of doctors have encountered parents who have completely opted out of vaccines. Now, King County is bucking that trend. The number of students who got all their recommended vaccines actually went up last year. But King County's health officer, Dr. Jeff Duchin, told KUOW's Emily Fox that there is still a lack of herd immunity in some pockets of King County, which could put kids at risk.
Herd immunity or population level immunity is basically the number of people in the community who are protected or immune from a disease so that it cannot spread easily from person to person when it is introduced into that community. So for example, with measles, we saw a large outbreak in 2015 that originated in California, Disneyland, and in communities or populations where there were unimmunized children, the disease is able to spread more rapidly. And that's what we see very characteristically with measles, because it spreads so easily through the airborne route. The number of people who need to be vaccinated or immune to prevent that spread is different for different diseases. And for measles, which is really the current most serious one that we're talking about in the context of childhood immunization, we need to have a high level of herd immunity. So 95% of kids really need to be vaccinated to prevent that from spreading effectively. You know, we have on the average about 92% of our kindergartners are vaccinated against measles with both vaccines, the two recommended vaccines. We have good general population level herd immunity against measles, but that 92% is comprised of communities where we have very high levels, 98, 99, 100, and then some that have lower in the 80s and even maybe in some schools less than that. So there are pockets of susceptibility where that herd immunity is not as high as it needs to be to prevent the spread in the community.
So like we saw at Disney, if let's say the measles were to come out here in King County, do you think we would see it spread like it did at Disney?
if it was introduced into a pocket or a community or a social network where many children were unvaccinated, it would spread. If it was introduced into a highly immunized population, a school where many of the kids or the vast majority of kids are immunized, it would be very unlikely to spread. So the point of vaccination is to build a wall, community immunity, so that even if someone comes in, and they invariably will, if not locally from other countries where these diseases are happening, if that disease is introduced, we have a wall of protected community members that will not allow that that germ to spread from person to person.
What do you think it would take to get all eligible kids vaccinated in King County?
Well, you know, it's a complex problem. Not all vaccine-hesitant parents are the same. They have different concerns. I think one of the key things that it will take is that parents need to have a good relationship with their healthcare provider, because that relationship and that counseling by the healthcare provider and education from the healthcare provider and hearing the parents' concerns and talking to them and giving them good quality information about the safety and effectiveness of vaccines is really the most important step to get more kids vaccinated.
Talking with Emily Fox, that's Jeff Duchin, the health officer for Seattle King County Public Health. Are you curious about the vaccination rate at your neighborhood school? We've got a link to King County's interactive map. We're tweeting that out now at KUOW. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I love camping. I hate camping. That's how Dan White starts his new book called Under the Stars. He writes about his personal journey to connect with nature and about how we created our car camping, REI shopping, backcountry culture. White told me camping is really just a Victorian passion that got out of hand after the Civil War. Men trying to find inspiration in nature, as the romantic poets once had. Except those romantic campers, they never went out into the woods alone. White says they feared the woods, and we're still scared.
It's amazing how we can toggle back to that fear. There's a new Blair Witch Project movie coming out. I have a feeling it'll be a smash, because it's something that we just have inside us, this inherent fear of the woods, in addition to these other factors too. But I think that we initially began to modulate that because we took these baby steps into the wild. I'm thinking of the romantic campers that you just referenced, and very often, I mean, almost to a man, they would not go out there by themselves. They would hire a guide, a wilderness guide. And these days, it's not that unusual to hire a wilderness guide if you're doing something technical, if you're climbing up a steep mountain, but these people would just hire a wilderness guide for any old workaday camp out. And the guides would do just about everything. They would build the campfire. They would slash the trees down to make a one-use shelter. They would pick the best places to camp. They would hunt and fish for you. But in a sense, they were also bodyguards against the perceived, the unknown, the beasts, the creatures out there. These people would keep you safe. And at the same time, they would kind of make everything authentic for you just by being there. In a sense, we had these baby steps, and I think even later on, with all the technology we use to go camping, the RVs that we use, the tents we use, the all-season gear we use, in a sense, what it does is it allows us to penetrate further into the backcountry, but in a sense, it also estranges us from the forces of nature and chaos that once repelled us from the woods. So I do think that over the years, human beings have developed these various hacks and buffers that allow us to go out into the woods without feeling like we're completely surrendering to it.
Is there something important about keeping the fear?
I think there is something important about keeping a healthy dose of apprehension. People need to go out there and have a healthy respect for what they're getting into. I think there needs to be a little bit of a healthy dose of caution. The idea that gear can break down, your GPS device can fall in a creek, that in a sense, expecting the worst from nature isn't the worst thing, because you should stay on your toes out there. I mean, I think that's part of it. But I also feel like having a healthy respect for the power of nature also reminds us of our place in the scheme of things. To not overplay our hands, to not meddle with nature too much.
You talk about how America fell in love with camping, but don't you mean white America mainly?
Basically, we had all of these values that were built into camping that were history specific and that were Caucasian specific. Transcendentalism in, you know, the 1830s and Nature being published by Emerson, you're thinking what's happening in the African-American community at the same time that's coming out. Well, there, that's, you know, slavery, millions of people enslaved. And then I think another value that's really tied up with camping, you know, look at any, just about any big RV brand, and there's this manifest destiny themes in all the RVs. And, you know, during manifest destiny, African-Americans were often oppressed violently in these territories that we were creating out west. And so there's a whole different kind of engagement with nature. And now, even though the demographics are really lopsided, you have these meetup groups, you have these advocacy groups for not just African-American campers, but also Hispanic campers, for Asian-American campers, who are, I think, going to change the demographic picture of camping within the next few years. I think that the picture is going to be different in the future.
And why is that important?
I think it's really important because we're thinking about these places as the commons. We're thinking about these places that we all pay taxes to support and protect. These places are ours. And it just gives me a kind of a strange feeling when I think, well, when we say ours, we're really just saying that as a euphemism for one group, because I think of the history of camping as something that starts off as very restricted and very elitist just for one small micro group, and then gradually it expands, becomes a bit more populist. And so if I see something that kind of goes against that democratic impulse, that evolution of camping, it makes me uneasy because I feel like I don't want to think I'm engaging in an elitist activity or an activity that's restricted to one group. I want camping to be for everybody because it takes place in these wild places that are set aside for everyone.
You wrote in your book, I love camping, I hate camping.
It's absolutely true. You know, it's funny because when I talk to people who love camping, I completely get it. And when I talk to people who would never go camping, I completely get it. There was a girl I interviewed when I did this trip out to the Everglades, a teenage kid, who said, this is dirty, this is gross, I can't stand this, except for selective moments. I don't want to do this again. And I completely related to it, except for someone like me, the whole experience in its entirety is addictive. And I think that I am willing to deal with the fact that I'm ambivalent about it because there's this enchantment that I find every time, because I have a sense of rapture along with all the other things that go wrong. And I think that after a while, one develops a certain camping attitude that allows us to deal with ambivalence. In other words, we go out there and we kind of expect to get the best and the worst of it. And I've just grown accustomed to this because I've been camping ever since I can remember, and I always have felt that kind of split.
Dan White's book is called Under the Stars, How America Fell in Love with Camping. Picture yourself lying in a hammock, gazing up at the dark sky at 10:30 in the morning. That's going to be possible. A year from now, there will be a total eclipse of the sun on August 21st, 2017 at 10:30 a.m. Why am I telling you about this right now? Because some of the best viewing spots are being snapped up. It's not going to be a total eclipse in Seattle. That will happen a few hours south of here. GeekWire's Alan Boyle says if you want to snag a total eclipse viewing spot, you may already be too late.
They're already reserving hotel rooms. It's hard to find a room in Portland or Salem or Corvallis, Oregon, all these cities that are in the track of the eclipse.
Why Oregon?
Because that's where the shadow of the moon touches down, and that's the closest place for people who generally listen to KUOW. If you want to get in on the full experience, you really have to go to Oregon.
Are there eclipse-watching events?
Yeah. I'm going to go to one in Madras, Oregon, that has NASA as one of the participants. It's called Solar Fest. But there are other events going on across the country. I'm sure there's going to be something in Jackson Hole, Carbondale, Illinois, Hopkinsville, Kentucky, Tennessee. There are certain centers that are trying to make a big deal out of this. So it'll be a party.
So Salem, Oregon, for example, gets 100% eclipse.
For sure. Mm-hmm.
We get, you said, low 90s?
Right.
How big a difference is that?
Big difference, yeah. And when you have an eclipse, you're looking at a partial eclipse. even in the when 90% of the sun's disk is covered, it's kind of like a dim day. It feels like you're getting towards sunset, that sort of feeling. So there isn't a noticeable effect. But when you get 100%, then the sun goes completely dark. You look up and there's this black hole in the sky surrounded by the beautiful glowing aurora of the sun's atmosphere, and everything is dark around you, and you've got lots of people hoopering and hollering around you, and so it's quite the experience. It's not to be missed.
In Seattle, if we're going to still see 3% of the sun, the rim, can we look directly at it?
No, you really shouldn't. It's like looking at the sun now. You can kind of glimpse up and take a look, but don't gaze at it. You really need eclipse glasses. And so that's one of the things that I try to remind people, that you better get your eclipse glasses before you get to a couple of days before the August 21st event next year.
Those aren't sunglasses?
No, sunglasses are not going to work. They're special glasses. They have a very, very dark filter. You can't see anything through the glasses except for that sliver of sun.
How rare is a total eclipse like the one we're expecting in August, a year from now?
Well, it's interesting. They're not really that rare when you look at how many there are. There might be two in the course of a year. There might be one total eclipse, and then you wait a couple of years, and there's another total eclipse. But the thing about these eclipses is that they're only visible along a narrow track of territory when they offer totality. And so you have to go to where the eclipse is. And sometimes that's Patagonia or Mongolia or some remote area of Antarctica. This time it's going to be all across the United States. So it might be one of the most accessible total solar eclipses of our lifetime.
Yeah, it's been a century or so since that's happened.
Since
in America.
Coast-to-coast eclipse in America, yeah.
So you're going to Madras, Oregon.
Yep.
What's the scene going to be like?
Well, I've got what they call a dry camping site because they are really selling out of hotel rooms. And so it's going to be a camping adventure, there are going to be a whole lot of people there. There are going to be folks setting up their telescopes with solar filters, and it's going to be a real party. And like I say, when the event happens, it's a very much a shared experience. It's kind of one of those things that's almost like a hearkening back to tribal days, you know, to the primitive days when people didn't know what was happening when some dragon ate the sun.
Can I come with you and perhaps sit on your shoulders?
Yeah, maybe we can roll out another sleeping bag in
Great.
The tent.
Great, thanks. Alan Boyle, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, even if
Same
it's about
way.
Something a year out.
You bet.
Alan Boyle, science writer in Seattle for GeekWire.com. Again, that full eclipse of the sun will happen Monday, August 21st. At 10:30 a.m. next year. Even if you are too late to reserve a perfect spot to view the eclipse, you do have plenty of time to pick up a pair of eclipse glasses so that you can view that safely. It's KUOW's The Record. The singular they. Have you heard about this? It's a gender-neutral pronoun, the they that doesn't care whether it's referring to a he or a she. For example, a parent wants their child to succeed. Grammarians cringe when they hear that. But last year, the American Dialect Society got behind the singular they. So did the Washington Post. And now, KUOW is adopting it, by which I mean they. Here's the person who made the call, KUOW's managing editor, Kathy Duchamp.
Well, there's two main reasons. First, it reflects the way people talk. And that's what broadcast writing is all about, is using the spoken word. Mm-hmm. So let me give you an example. If a listener writes us, we write them back.
A listener, we write them back.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it makes sense, right? Spoken word, but it's singular
right.
and plural. But if we were to be proper grammarians, we would say, if a listener writes us, we write him or her back. And that's clumsy.
It's clunky.
Yeah, so that's one reason. But here's the real reason. The more important reason is that the singular they is a way that people refer to themselves if they don't want to be identified by a gender pronoun, by he or she. And this came up actually last Monday in a story Paige Browning did about a couple being chastised for showing affection in public outside Safeco Field.
Seattle resident Mary McHale was at the game, too, with their significant other. The fun ended when they were waiting for a ride outside the ballpark.
My sweetheart looked at me and said, you know, what a great time we were having. And we kissed. And not doing anything obscene or anything that would make any of the other folks standing around us uncomfortable. And that's when a Safeco Field employee came out and looked at us and said, ladies, I'm going to have to ask you to stop.
McHale says it was humiliating for multiple reasons. It was Pride Night, for one, and neither McHale nor their partner go by female pronouns.
So the alternative to that female pronoun is singular they.
Yes, which to our ear might sound a little strange, Mary and their significant other, but actually, there's a history to this, right, Ken?
Yeah, there's a history. Language experts say the singular they has been on the books for hundreds of years. Chaucer used it, Shakespeare, Jane Austen.
But most people don't know that, and no. I'm guessing you hear from critics about this.
Right. The critics say it's just wrong. Singular is he or she. Plural is they. These are the grammar rules that students have grown up with over the past 100 years, and it is what it is. I mean, that's what I learned in seventh grade grammar with Mr. Gilstrap. You know, and even the Chicago Manual of Style actually has recommendations for how to write around, you know, the singular they, how to avoid it, to avoid the debate altogether.
Yes. So you hear from critics, maybe even some in our newsroom who've never done it this way. What do you say to them, managing editor?
Well, what I've said is singular they, when we get back to history, it was eliminated in the Victorian era simply as a way to tidy up the language. But the deal is English is not a tidy language. And we want to, most important, recognize gender fluidity. And the singular they is as close as we get in the English language. But Bill, you know what sealed the deal with the reporters? Was this video that's making its way around social media right now. It's a Baltimore Sun editor, John McIntyre, and he says he's done arguing about the singular they.
The reason I'm not going to argue with you is that your views don't matter. The only people enforcing the prohibition against singular they are school teachers and copy editors. Most schools have abandoned teaching traditional grammar, and publishers have been dropping copy editors the way a golden retriever sheds in the springtime.
I like the prim classical music added in there as well. Now, this doesn't mean we're dropping he or she entirely.
No, absolutely not. But here's where I think we're going with this. Right now, when we interview people, we ask them, hey, what's your name? Where are you from? We may get to a point where we ask a third question, which is, how should we identify you in terms of gender? He, she, or they?
Are KUOW reporters asking people that now when they contact them?
Not right now. In this case, the Paige Browning story, people self-identified proactively. And that's where I think we're going to start, because it's a whole new conversation that people are having.
KUOW Managing Editor Kathy Duchamp telling you why our radio station is adopting the use of the singular they. I would love to know what you think. Are you glad KUOW is going this direction? Are you frustrated we are ignoring traditional grammar rules? Let us know on Twitter right now, at KUOW. KUOW's The Record, I'm Bill Radke. Fresh off the Olympic Games, Brazil now hosts the Paralympic Games. Athletes from the Northwest are packing up to fly south to compete in sports such as wheelchair rugby, sitting volleyball, and goal ball. We had not heard of goal ball before, so we sent KUOW's Tom Bonsi to Portland, where half the U.S. women's national team lives.
Quiet, please. Play.
This three-on-three game is played indoors on a volleyball-sized court. The roughly 3-pound medicine ball the players throw has bells in it. That's because these athletes are all blind or visually impaired. Defenders crouch, reach, slide, or lunge when they hear the ball coming at them. The court is marked off with tactile lines made with masking tape over string so the players can feel where they are.
Goal!
I asked 7-time U.S. Paralympian Jen Armbruster of Portland what sport goal ball is most similar to.
Reverse dodgeball.
Reverse dodgeball? I thought of dodgeball, too.
Yeah, reverse dodgeball.
Remember, in dodgeball, the object is to avoid the thrown ball. Here in goal ball, the defending team puts their bodies in the way of the ball, aimed at the wide goal behind them.
So it's a much heavier ball going a lot faster. But yeah, your defense is very much a soccer goalie. You know, you're defending and using your body to defend it, and then the underhand motion is like a softball pitcher. Yeah. You know, it's underhand or sidearm, because it's got to be low.
High ball!
Armbruster says she transitioned to goal ball from basketball in her teens when optic nerve degeneration gradually took her eyesight. She says she loves team sports and the team experience.
Being part of a team is usually what draws a lot of people in. It's just that feeling of, like, I do belong here. This is a sport that I can play, and I can play with my sighted friends because guess what? I can slap a blindfold on them and take them out here.
U.S. Paralympic teammate Ileana Mason is a senior at Portland State University. Mason says she was introduced to goal ball at a sports camp for visually impaired kids during high school.
I honestly wasn't that into goal ball at first. Then my first practice, they just kind of like hammered me with balls. And afterwards, I kind of looked at my dad and I was like, you know, I don't know if I really like this. Like,
she was a gymnast and I saw her and said, hey, you're athletic, you really should try. And she's like, yeah, okay, whatever.
I just wanted to do handstands on the court.
Mason was born with cataracts and glaucoma, giving her blurry vision. Because goalball players have varying levels of sight, they all wear blackout eye masks, so everyone is equally blind on the court. Mason says the competitive aspects of the game eventually hooked her.
I just fell in love with the sport. We play it so much that, like, you have dreams about playing the sport. Like, after a training camp, I'll, like, wake up with my hands in the air, like, trying to block a ball in my sleep.
Goalball was invented in Europe right after World War II to help blinded veterans stay active. It came to America a few decades later. There are about 15 club teams around the Northwest, but as yet no organized leagues.
Quiet, please. Center.
Spectators have to be quiet during matches, which might make things interesting in Brazil, where the fans have a boisterous reputation. The troubled economy in the host city and country has forced consolidation of Paralympic Games venues and budget cutbacks, but all planned sports will still be contested. 5-time Paralympian Asia Miller of Portland says she followed the Olympic Games in Rio to get a sense of what she's in for.
I'm not expecting to go down there to stay in a 5-star resort. I know that, you know, so I don't, you know, I'm going down there to play. I'll deal with whatever's thrown at me while I'm there, but I'm really going down there to play.
The U.S. women enter the Rio Paralympics as the defending world champions in goal ball. Their first game is against host country Brazil on September 8th. I'm Tom Bonsi in Portland.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. It is now 3 weeks until Fertility Day. In Italy, the government declared Fertility Day, September 22nd, as part of its campaign to convince women to make more babies because the population is plummeting. How do Italian women react to this call? You'll find out this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered. Earlier this hour, we were talking about Georgetown University's decision to give admissions preference to descendants of the slaves once owned by the Maryland Jesuits. Two Maryland Jesuits who were presidents of Georgetown sold slaves to pay off Georgetown's debts in the early 1800s. Our next guest has thought a lot about how our history as a slave-owning nation informs our power structures today. Becca Meredith is a local activist and organizer for CARW, that's the Coalition for Anti-Racist Whites. Nationally, she works with SURGE, an acronym for Showing Up for Racial Justice. And she told me why it's important for white people to get involved in racial justice activism. Often it begins with white guilt.
By a feeling of that they have more than other people have, and that they've probably done a lot of little and big things in their lives that have been sort of playing out their white privilege. So I think actually white guilt is most often an entry place for white people. And
that's okay?
That's okay. I think the biggest piece is that when you're feeling that white guilt, that often guilt is actually immobilizing you. It's keeping you in the white culture. It's like, oh, I feel guilty about all these things. There's a retreating that happens. And, you know, sometimes we talk about guilt as actually a tool of racism to keep white folks in place because it's so uncomfortable to, like, move through that and to recognize I have no idea how to be in the world differently. And that's going to be a really hard path. And there's probably going to be a lot of guilt and shame and confusion. And so, yeah.
What are you asking white people to do?
We ask white folks to join the struggle for racial justice. Educating yourself through reading or watching movies.
Educating myself about what?
What is, you know, what's racism? What is it?
Are you asking white folks to see themselves as racist?
You know, we do have a definition of racism as access to institutionalized power plus prejudice. Anyone can have prejudice, regardless of your race and how you've been racialized in this country. But because of the way the systems have been built in our country, only white folks have access to institutionalized power. And so often when you make that definition, you say that all white people are racist. We at CARW, which is the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, where I organize, we use that definition and we often give it. But what we find in terms of our end goal of mobilizing people towards action is that that definition or telling people that they all white folks are racist is like, yes, and don't get stuck in the guilt of it. We want to move you into action, to changing systems, to putting our bodies on the line, to having difficult conversations. And sometimes that sort of the weight of that definition is...
Yeah, you've already come to terms, possibly, with the idea of your own racism.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah.
But to talk to somebody, to another white person is offended. That's enough. White liberals hate to be called racist.
Mm-hmm.
It's threatening. Mm-hmm. It's offensive to many people.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know you're actually doing any good? How do you know you're not just turning people off and creating hostility instead of what you want?
Yeah. I think organizing, you know, what we're doing is organizing a movement for social change is built on relationships. And we really operate in the model that we need to meet people where they're at. I think that goes for people in our families, but also, you know, we have a big meeting, we have a bunch of people on a big spectrum of their understanding of the work. And yeah, we want to be building bridges and not breaking them down. And so if that definition is really offensive to people, if that person is still open to a conversation about why it's offensive or discussing a way in which they can enter the work, often our fear of being labeled racist is really rooted in this sort of idea of perfectionism, which is so deep in our kind of white culture, which is, you know, it's like, I figured it all out. I did the research. I read the books. I don't say anything that's messed up. I've got it. I'm fine. Don't like taint this that I've created. And so it's this really tight holding on this concept of perfectionism that is really harmful for our movements. And there's really no room to grow in that or get feedback. So I think kind of trying to support people in seeing that we're all flawed and we're all going to make mistakes and that's okay. And it's not actually your individual fault that you are a racist in our system, you know? The system of racism has been built around you, and you have inherited this.
Okay, that might make me a little more comfortable if I'm a well-meaning white person.
Yeah.
Right? It's not my fault. This is just the part I've been forced to play. I feel more comfortable. Do you want white folks to feel uncomfortable?
We do, ultimately, but we need you in the door first. So, okay, you're feeling a little better. You understand that it's not your fault that white supremacy exists and that you maybe walk around the world and do racist stuff every day. Now we kind of, we bring you in and we say, great, you want to be a part of this movement. One of the pieces of being a part of this work is getting uncomfortable.
How might I be uncomfortable? I'll be your, I'll be the surrogate here. I don't like to be uncomfortable.
You know, let's say,
Becca,
you have a coworker. I know it sucks. It really sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you asking me to do?
I feel that. It could be really small, like your partner at home kind of says something that's sort of off, and you
I've got a partner
or I have a friend who's, or a family, especially family member, mm-hmm. right? Family.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they say something tone deaf.
Yeah.
But come on, that's just who they are. Mm-hmm. What are we going to, are we going to ruin every friendship?
Right.
Over racism? What should I do about a friend, a family member?
Yeah.
I don't want to lecture them, Becca.
Right. I think there's two things to think about. One is that the work is built on relationships. So the goal of that conversation should always be to stay connected most of the time. I mean, I'm thinking about like the hyper sort of bigoted, just egregious behavior that you probably just don't really want to be around that person that much anyways. So that's sort of like the exception. But for folks that are kind of engaging in some kind of meaningful way, but they're just off, those are the folks we definitely want to talk to. And then so relationship building, and also that you have no idea where that person is on their journey to waking up. And you might create that moment for someone else. And it just takes that risk of mentioning it. It may not be the crystallization moment, but it may be a seed that's going to be, you know, fully blossom in a year or 5 years. So I think not just assuming as much when you are hearing certain things from folks. We do this activity in CARW called naming and framing, which is basically a practice of having those difficult conversations. And, you know, sometimes it's good to start with questions. Like if someone says, it's so cool that Obama got elected. We're in a really post-racial society. It's beautiful.
What would I say to that?
Yeah, I mean, you can start with different, there's sort of different approaches. One could be questions. So that's really interesting. Where did you hear that? Oh, I heard it on blah, 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 this or that. Oh, okay. You know, sort of inquiring in and trying to figure out where did it come from? And maybe saying like, does it feel true to you? You know, because sometimes people are just regurgitating what they're hearing. So it's sort of connecting that person to their actual experience and maybe some other stories that are happening, like Black people getting killed every week, you know, every 28 hours in this country. Does that feel like we're in a post-racial society? You know, just kind of surfacing
questions.
Some
That's
facts.
Good. Questions are non-threatening.
They are. You know, they're a great way, especially for someone who you may feel might be defensive anyways, but I think it's just a good approach. Sometimes it's good to really go back to your own experience. So, you know, I used to think we were in a post-racial society too. You know, back in 2008, that, you know, Obama got elected, it was so amazing. And, you know, the other day I heard about this White Lives Matter group, which is now being dubbed a hate group. And I'm just realizing that we are not in a post-racial society, you know, and so just sharing your own journey.
And you started on common ground. Oh, yeah. I thought the exact same thing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then it's like, let me tell you a story, because mm-hmm. everybody loves a story.
Exactly.
And we've already agreed that we're together.
Yeah.
And then this happened.
Yeah.
You've talked about taking a risk. Mm. On the surface, in liberal Seattle, organizing with a group called Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites doesn't sound very risky. It can sound a little self-congratulatory, you know, group of good white people. So I'm asking, what are you risking in Seattle by being anti-racist? And do you have
good
to risk?
Question.
Should you be risking something?
I think we should all be risking something to change the way that things are. And we should all be find that edge for our own personal growth.
Yeah. Where's that edge for you?
For me right now, my risk edge is being more vocal and more visible in the Seattle racial justice movement.
Why is that risky?
Because I'm worried that I'm going to screw up, say the wrong thing on radio.
Yeah, you're in front of a microphone. That's risky. But what would you say wrong? You're talking about anti-racism. That seems like safe ground.
Because this organizing is multifaceted and people have different approaches. And, you know, I'm a white person who's getting airtime. Shouldn't a person of color be sitting in this seat?
Do you think there's truth to that? Are you soaking up somebody's attention or being presumptuous right now by being coalition of anti-racist white people?
I definitely think it's true. We need to pass the mic. White folks are used to being heard. That was a big practice of mine early on when I sort of came into the work, and I've always been kind of a, whatever that word is, sort of overachiever in school. I know the answer, and you know, I sort of came in with that kind of energy, and I've learned a lot of kind of just stepping back and following the leadership of folks of color in this work who are on the front lines every freaking day and just like leading with action and vision that is just, you know, paving the way for this organizing. And I'm just, everything that I have learned is so much tied to folks of color in this work. And we are often asked and have been asked for generations as white folks to organize our people and educate our people.
Do white people need to lose something to sacrifice something mm-hmm. for people of color to get some justice?
You know, I think we operate on a sort of really deep level that we all will benefit from racism ending. We all gain. We are all dehumanized by the system of racism that plays out in this country, and we really need to come into the work seeing our own stake in it.
Becca Meredith is an organizer for CARW, the Coalition of Anti-Racist Whites, and Surge, Showing Up for Racial Justice. What did that conversation bring up for you? What is your story? What is your work? What is your risk? Let us know at the email address record@kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. Last week, we had a conversation on the show about dog parks. Off-leash advocates want Seattle to provide more dog parks, special hours at public parks when dogs can run free, another dog beach, because there's only one beach now where dogs can run around. That's Magnuson Park. Some of our panelists in this discussion said we have enough off-leash space, and there was some frustration expressed with owners who let their dogs off the leash in unauthorized areas. And I figured you would tell us how you felt about all of this. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, I don't suppose we heard from some dog owners?
Yeah, so people on Twitter think that KOW hates dogs now.
Come on now.
Thank you, Week in Review.
We Come also on, got Twitter, that's not so.
We also got this email from Jerry who says, please ask your panel to do a bit more research on dog barks before they discuss parks, by the way, not barks.
Not barks, yeah.
The first answer felt dismissive, she says. Your guest stated that the number of dog parks is 14, which sounds like a lot. However, that number is misleading.
I think there are 14 dog parks. So how's that misleading?
So there are, but according to the city's report, those 14 parks amount to 28 acres. The entire Seattle park system is comprised of 6,200 acres of land. And I did a little math, and that means off-leash areas amount to less than 0.5% of Seattle parks.
Yeah. And less than 0.5%. Is that enough? We also have to consider maybe that we've got all these new Seattle apartments and condos that presumably contain dog owners with no yards, nowhere else to go. So good feedback. Is less than 0.5% of parkland enough off-leash land? Let us know how you feel. Dog owners and cat owners and pet abstainers, send us your feedback on any story, anytime, to record@KUOW. One last thing. Just this hour, we were telling you about how KUOW has moved to the singular they, a gender-neutral pronoun. And if, in case you missed it, you can read about it at our website. We have written out KOW's rationale. A couple of tweets in response to that. Someone says, fantastic. Hearing it in common use will really help me personally to remember to use it. It matters to people I love. Also, so pleased at KOW is adopting singular they. This hashtag non-binary person salutes you, and we salute you too.